name is Adam. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. And I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be sober. My sobriety date is June 23rd of 2007. And I have a sponsor and I have a home group. And thanks again, Billy, for asking me to come down and speak. It's really like an honor for me to be in a room full of a lot of the people who have saved my life. It's really how I feel about this. And because there's been a number of times where I've been unwilling to call my sponsor, you know, because I feel like he's going to tell me something I don't want to hear, and I want to do something, you know, or I'm like worried about looking bad, and Billy's the guy that I've called, you know, and for me, like I'm grateful to have people like that in my life that I can call, you know, when I'm really not feeling good, and every single time I've called him, you know, he's been someone who's kind of told me the truth, but he does it in a kind way, you know, and I feel like that's a really good example of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's something that I really value, and, you know, so, I don't know if I'm going to have time to get to everything I want to talk about, but, I grew up in Charlottesville, Virginia, a little bit past here, and really, like, I have no idea whether or not I was born an alcoholic. I don't really get into that debate very often, but I know that I was born painfully, painfully self-centered. And for as long as I can remember, I've been obsessed with the idea of what other people are thinking of me, you know. And pretty much, like, that's my, you know, my earliest memories are really of trying to get people's attention and acceptance, you know. And for most of my life, that's been has been my bottom line. You know, is how can I get you to like me, and how can I like feel affirmed, and really like every major decision I made in my life until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous was the bottom line. You know, is how can I get people to like me, and how can I feel okay in my own skin. You know, and I don't know if it makes me alcoholic that I didn't feel comfortable in my own skin, but I honestly I would have rather been anywhere else. You know. Been anyone else, like doing something else, you know, our book describes it as restless, irritable, and discontent, but that's how it felt to me, you know, is that I would see other people and I would just wish that I was doing what they were doing, you know, and really, like, it's not anything that's drastically different than what I do most days now, you know, which is that I went through most of my life just kind of trying to figure out how I could get the things that I want and was haunted by this constant sense of fear that I wasn't going to get things, you know, and for me, I had some things that happened when I was growing up that put me, I mean, I don't know if they actually did make me different, but they definitely made me feel different. You know, my dad, I don't know if he's alcoholic or not, but he really liked cocaine and he really liked alcohol. And most of my childhood was spent, you know, things would be going really, really well for a month, 2 months, 3 months, and then my dad would, like, disappear. You know, my house would kind of, like, be a wreck. My mom would be crying, and it would just be, and every couple of months, there was just a breakdown like that, and then my dad would come back from rehab, things would be great, you know, he would, like, get a job, like, life would be good, and then, like, you know, a couple months later, he would lose his job, or be looking for another job, and be on the couch all the time, and then, you know, there would just be another breakdown, and so most of my childhood, like, I had experience with what alcohol and drugs can do to you. You know, I couldn't claim ignorance when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and when I started drinking. And that experience really, you know, I remember having the attitude of being, of really being hesitant about alcohol and drugs because of that, you know. And this is, like, one of the most important things about somebody like me, which is that knowing that and having those convictions about alcohol and drugs, you know, I still started drinking, and I still started doing drugs, you know? And the reason was that, it was the same reason I did everything else at that period of time, because I wanted to be cool, you know? Like, my friends, like, started dressing like skateboarders and skateboarding around, and so I started doing that. I'm terrible, terrible at skateboarding, right? We would just like go down a big hill on our skateboards and we were skateboarders. And so I did that and I started vandalizing because my friends were vandalizing, you know? I started setting things on fire because my friends were doing that. And I started drinking because my friends were drinking, you know? I wasn't trying to run away from anything. I wasn't trying to blot out my painful seventh grade existence, you know? I was just doing it because I was trying to, it was just the next thing, you know? And so that was like what I thought going into it, but I don't know if I had a different effect than they did, but I mean, alcohol did not do what I expected it to do. You know, I wasn't expecting to have that fear that I carried around with me constantly kind of fall away. You know, but I really vividly remember just having, when, you know, taking a couple shots and then having it hit me and feeling like, you know, like, I couldn't believe how comfortable I felt all of a sudden. You know, that feeling of, like, that I've been desperately trying to get through dressing a certain way or talking a certain way or, you know, convincing people to like me. Like, all the effort that I put in, you know, and I got it immediately from taking a drink. And my first drink was Aristocrat vodka, and I never really got much more high class than that, you know. I drank Aristocrat, I drank Wild Irish Rose, I drank Steel Reserve, you know. I didn't drink because I liked the taste, you know. I didn't drink because it was like the social thing to do. I drank for effect, you know. And I remember also that my thought process when I started drinking was that I had these friends who would always be telling stories about, like, you know, this is what we did last weekend, and so-and-so did this crazy thing, and I really just wanted people to be able to tell stories about me the next day, which I got, you know, like, I got that immediately, because I drank, and I blacked out, and the next day, people told stories about crazy Adam James, you know, and it was, it was one of the greatest days of my life, honestly, you know, to finally, like, have, and I developed a reputation really quickly, because I started drinking all the time. You know, I wasn't one of those people who had an imaginary line to cross. Like, I did it. I felt amazing. I liked blacking out. I wasn't responsible for anything I did or said, and people paid attention to me. It's like, yes, sign me up, you know? And so I started doing that all the time. And I started on a swim team. And so, you know, I could go away. I could be away from home for like a week, you know, and drink every night. And it was amazing. Honestly, like, amazing. And alcohol, you know, some people talk about alcohol changing their perception, and that definitely happened for me, but alcohol really did change my life, you know. It was a 180-degree turn in the way that people, even the people around me treated me, you know, because for the first time in my life, like, I was comfortable enough to be able to talk to people and comfortable enough to be able to, like, put myself out there and make friends. And I switched schools also, so I started drinking the summer between switching schools. And when I went to this new school, I was the man, you know, like, and like I said, like, some people say, like, I felt like I was the man. I was the man. People knew me, like, they would say what's up to me in the hallway, like, people knew my name, I got invited to stuff, like, it did actually change my life, you know, and that, paired with the massive sense of relief that I felt, it was a no-brainer for someone like me to drink, you know, and if things had stayed like that, I would have just kept drinking, to be honest with you. You know, that wouldn't have been a question in my mind. But what happened to me is that I alcohol just started being a more and more important part of my life, you know. And that's kind of the first thing, one of the first things ever related to an Alcoholics Anonymous was when they talked about alcoholism being a progressive disease, you know, and that it gets worse, never better. Because for me, it just, you know, over any given period of time, alcohol becomes more and more important part of my life, you know, and it doesn't matter how important stuff used to be, it just starts kind of fading into the background, you know, and at first, it was stuff that wasn't really that big of a deal, you know, it was, you know, sports, it's, all right, whatever, you know, like, I can be successful without sports, my grades, like, well, high school's not really that important, and then it started being things like, you know, my family, the friends that I used to have who were boring now because they weren't drinking every night, and just things like that, and really, like, I wish I could say that alcohol, like, took those things away from me, or that even that I consciously made a decision, you know, to drink instead or something, but really, I'm so selfish that I just don't care about stuff that doesn't make me feel good, you know, and if it boils down to, like, I'm going to go out tonight and drink, or hang out with a bunch of people who are just talking, like, sorry, guys, you know, like, I'm going to go drink, and I found people who drank like I did, you know, And I switched groups of friends. Like, I could take a whole hour talking to all the different groups of friends that I went through. But, you know, long story short, I found the people who drank the way that I wanted to drink, you know, and I found the people who lived really the way that I wanted to live, you know, and it took me about 9 months, until I was, you know, not really going to school, and I was hanging out with a group of people in, if any of you are familiar with Charlottesville, Southwood Trailer Park was where they were hanging out, and in a trailer there that we called the Pit, and which is pretty much exactly what it was. It was just like a pit, you know, of just madness. And my best friends were Corey, was, you know, then there was Skunk, and then there was Trip, and we were the best of friends. And these are the people that were doing the kind of things I wanted to do. You know, these were the people that were drinking every day before school. They were leaving school to drink during the day. They were drinking after school. They didn't really care about their families. You know, it was just like, and for me, I felt this sense of excitement and, like, fulfillment and being a part of something that I'd never felt ever in my entire life by hanging out with these guys. And at the time, I would really have done anything for them, you know. And needless to say that, like, that was paired with the fact that my relationship with my family just was just steadily going downhill, you know. And this is, like, one of, you know, I think the more important things, at least for me to remember, which is that he talks about in our book that, you know, we are demanding or gracious, whatever the case may be, you know, when it's talking about being self-will. And that's really, like, the first place I could ever really see that in my story was with my family, you know, because at first I wanted to get out the door and I wanted to drink, you know, and if I felt like I had to look my mom in the eye and say, I love you, you know, like, I'll do chores, like, how was your day, and, like, be really, like, kind to get out the door, then I would do that, you know, and if I felt like I had to look her dead in the eye and say, like, I hate you, I want you to die, so that she would let me go, I would do that. Like, to me, it didn't really make a difference, you know, because I'm the kind of person that my feelings are the bottom line, and alcohol makes me feel better, you know, and if, whatever I got to do to get there, you know, like, whatever I got to do, and so I had, you know, after that 9 months or so, I had gotten to a point where there's no more, you know, I love you, how's your day, you know, it was get out of my way. And that was really how I felt about pretty much everyone who was getting in my way. It was, I just wish that people would leave me alone and let me drink the way I wanted to drink, you know. Because I started having this feeling in my gut that, like, whenever I wasn't drinking, I felt like all those old fears and stuff start coming back, you know. And I had, like, a reprieve from that when I first started drinking. But, you know, the times when I was sober, the brief periods of time when I was sober during the day, I had that feeling of, like, anxiety and fear. And I don't even know if I can put words to it, but just, like, a pit in my stomach. Like, someone was grabbing me in the gut, you know, all the time. And I'm not a dumb guy. I know that drinking fixes that, you know. And I know that being nice to my family doesn't. So it's get out of my way is how I feel. And there's a couple, like, time, and more and more frequently, you know, what would happen is that, you know, my mom wasn't just one of those people who was going to let me do whatever I wanted to. You know, she's, like, a really strong woman. You know, all the stuff she went through with my dad. She's been a member of Al-Anon for 10 years or something. She's a really amazing person, you know. But, so she wasn't just going to let me just walk out of the house and get drunk every night. But, you know, she just got to the point where she didn't know what else she could do, you know, because I would go to whatever lengths I had to leave, you know. And I remember one night she was begging me not to leave the house. And my little sister, who was, I guess, 10 at this time, was standing at the top of the stairs, and I knew that she was up there, and I pulled out a knife and held it to my throat and said, I'm going to kill myself if you don't let me leave, you know, in front of my 10-year-old sister. And I wish that I could say that after that I felt really guilty, but I didn't, you know. I really felt like if these people just don't understand me, you know, and they don't understand what I got to do, and if they just left me alone, I wouldn't have to do stuff like that. So it's not my fault, you know. And I remember, you know, another time being out on the front porch and calling a taxi to come and pick me up from my house and to get out of there, and my mom getting on the other end of the phone and begging me not to leave, you know, and me just, like, saying, get off the phone, you know. And the reason I said that was because I was embarrassed that she was doing that in front of the taxi company, you know. Not because I felt bad about what I was doing, but because I was like, the taxi company's on the other end, you know. Like, what are you doing right now? You're embarrassing me. And, which, I mean, like, it sounds ridiculous now. But at the time, I couldn't believe that my mom would embarrass me in front of people like that. And this is from the person who, at this point, had, like, a foot-tall mohawk, you know, was, like, you know, going to school, like, I thought I was, like, a goth, you know, and I was, like, going to school with, like, dressed in all black. I mean, I looked like an idiot, really. But I was embarrassed that my mom was talking like this to some person I didn't know. But these things became an everyday occurrence, you know. I mean, And also, the other thing was that my drinking, by this point, had assumed, like, more serious proportions, right? Like, I always drank to blackout, but at this point, I would be drinking every night, and you know, at the beginning, it was like, I might have one bad night a week, you know, and then a couple, and, like, six good nights, you know? And at the end, it was, at the end of that 9 months, it was just, you know, six bad nights and maybe one good night. And by good night, I just mean nothing tragic happened, you know. It wasn't, like exceptional. It was just nothing really bad happened, you know. But it was, like, car crash, someone overdosing, not wanting to take him to the hospital because I'll get in trouble. How do I deal with that, you know, that moral dilemma? And then, you know, the next night, just, like, having the cops called on my house. You know, the next day getting arrested. And, like, and just, like, one thing after another. And then maybe just one night where things were just okay, you know. And also, you know, I would wake up every morning and just feel like, you know, if I wasn't still, you know, on something from the day before, I just felt this, like, feeling in my gut of just, like, loneliness, you know, that I can't even really, I couldn't really do justice to, you know. I could be around all my friends and just feel like I was totally alone. And I really felt like the world was against me, which is a lonely place to be, you know, when everybody's against you and then no one understood me, you know. And this was a couple notches up from your normal teenage angst, you know, because I knew that alcohol would fix that. And I guess so that's like a slice of life from after about 9 months of drinking for me. And what happened is that if you live that way for long enough, they will send you away, right? Which I didn't think it was that funny, but they did. And they told me I was going to go to rehab. And this was after I'd run away from home and had like slept in a deserted barn out in, I don't even know where it was, past Charlottesville. So if you just keep going down 29, wherever that is, I was somewhere down there. I slept in a barn near my friend's house because I'd run away from home. I'd walked like 10 miles in my shoes. I was wearing moccasins. They'd like fallen apart. It was like a really bad experience, you know, and some other really terrible stuff happened. And then I went back and they were like, we're going to send you to rehab, you know, and which I thought, you know, 30 days, 60 days, honestly, I felt like it would be a vacation from the way that I've been living, you know, and that I would just come back and keep drinking and you know, no problem there. And we drove down to Farmville, Virginia, or it was near Farmville. It was Dillon, Virginia, right? The biggest city nearby is Farmville, Virginia. And they told me that. I was like, are you kidding? Farmville, right? And we just like kept going deeper and deeper into the forest. It wasn't a whole lot more dramatic than they just dropped me off, you know, at this institution that was down there. For some of you that know Al J down in Dillon, it's the sister school to the one that he runs, and it was a long-term wilderness program. And really, it was like, I don't know if you've ever heard of Holes, like that book where they just put a bunch of kids in the desert and tell them to dig holes. But it was kind of like that, except instead of holes, I just like did manual labor all the time. And I remember signing the contract to go in there, and it said 15 to 18 months, and I was like, what? Right? Like 15 to 18 months? And the reason that terrified me was because if there wasn't going to be alcohol there for 15 to 18 months, I could not comprehend that, you know? I hadn't gone more than 13 days without a drink since I started drinking, you know? Like 14 to 18 months just wasn't going to happen. And you know, the honest truth about that place is that I went to sleep and woke up every single day obsessing about alcohol, you know, because, you know, really for the first extended period of time, all those fears, all that anxiety, all that what are people thinking about me, like all of that came back full force, right? Like no reprieve from it. And I knew that a drink would fix that, and I couldn't have one. And I thought about that every single day, you know, that I was there. And I tried all sorts of stuff to, like, get out of my, to get messed up while I was there, to, like, get some relief. Like, they told me, this kid told me that he put cocaine in some gold bonds, so I, like, snorted some gold bonds. They told me that these moths would get me high, so I ate maybe 10 moths, you know. They told me these berries would get me messed up. I ate a ton of berries. Like, I was that kid in rehab who was just, like, a tweaker, who would just do whatever, you know, to, like, get messed up. I tried to drink sanitizer, hand sanitizer. It was out of control, the things I would do. It's funny, but really I did that because I couldn't stand the way that I felt sober, you know? And for me, just sobering up doesn't fix what's wrong with me, you know? Just sobering up just makes me painfully aware of why I drink, you know? And so I was there for 15 months, and after about 4 months of not drinking, I decided to run away. Because I... And kids ran away from this place all the time, obviously. But I thought that the reason they didn't get away was because they weren't resourceful enough, you know, that they would just run off into the woods. And it's like, they're going to get you, right? Like, where are you going to make it to Farmville? And then what are you going to do, you know? And so, you know, I just thought that, and so that's why I thought that nobody got away, because they just run off into the woods, and then they find you, and you come back, and then you're a lot of trouble. So I decided to hotwire a med van and drive to Virginia Beach and live on the beach drinking vodka, right? Which was like the glorious end of the tunnel to the problems I was having. And the only problem really was that the only experience I had with hotwiring cars was what I'd seen in Gone in 60 Seconds. And I remembered that like line from there that was like bumblebees and Christmas trees about like you got to put the yellow to the black and the green to the whatever, black or brown, I guess, like whatever that means. I didn't know how to hotwire cars is the point. And I found someone who did know how to hotwire cars and got them on board with my plan. So I'll like try and paint this picture. We were in the woods, and there's a guy who walks around to make sure that no one's running away, right? And so there's like a patrol person. So we snuck out and got into the van, and it should have been like boom, boom, go, you know, to like avoid the possibility of getting caught. And all we did, but this kid actually, I mean, he didn't really know what he was doing either, and so he got the windshield wipers going, which wasn't helping me out, you know what I mean, at this point. Like, this is a felony, and he's not helping me out by just getting the windshield wipers going. And then he got the lights flashing and the horn to, like, start going off, too. And so at that point, I was like, we just gotta go. So we just ran off into the woods, like every other dumb kid who's, like, tried to do this before. And broke into every single car. And we left at 11. We ran all night until 6 in the morning. And we broke into every single car that we passed is the other thing, and tried to hotwire that, and were no more successful. We found a Corvette. The keys were in it. Not the keys to the Corvette, though, which was unfortunate. You know, we thought about going to the guy's house and getting the Corvette keys, because that would have been a blaze of glory way to escape, you know, but no luck. And really, if you've ever been to the Dillon meeting in Dillon, like the Dillon AA meeting, I've broken into half of those people's cars, you know, but I figured that I'd made it at least 20 miles away from this rehab, because I'd been running all night long, and so I just figured we would just lay low, you know, and I would reevaluate the plan in the morning. And so I woke up and I went out on the road, and a van screeched up within maybe 30 seconds, and someone jumped out and tackled me, you know, which was unbelievable response time for this place. And I also couldn't figure out how they got me so fast. I was like, there's like a 30-mile radius, and they got me within 30 seconds? Like, are you kidding? And then we were driving back, and I figured that I've been running all night. It was going to take us a while, but we were back in under 5 minutes. And I was like, what? Right? Like, and apparently the road around the school is just a big loop, a 30-mile loop. And I had run out and around this whole school and maybe like however 20 miles, however far that was, and wound up maybe 15 feet from where I'd started. Maybe. I was like not feeling too good about myself, because like I'm in trouble. I was just like, I was an idiot, right? I was a loser. The thing that, other than the hurt ego, the thing that really terrified me was that I was going to have to stay there longer, and that I wasn't going to be able to drink, which was an unbearable thought, because like I said, I obsessed about alcohol constantly. And so eventually I got out of that place, you know. I would drink every single time they would let me go home while I was there. And had I gotten caught any one of those times, the 20 or so felonies that that were hanging over my head from breaking into all those cars would have gone into effect. And I would not do well in jail. And I knew that, and I would drink anyways, you know, because honestly, like, and this is probably the most important thing that I can say about, like, what makes me alcoholic, is that when push comes to shove, like, at that moment, no matter what the consequences are of taking that drink, how I know that it will make me feel is always going to be more important, every single time, you know? Because I don't know whether or not drinking is going to get me in trouble for sure, right? It probably is, right? But I don't know for sure. But I know for a fact that I feel unbearable sober, and I know for a fact that drinking will make me feel better, you know? And that's what makes someone like me such a hopeless alcoholic, is that there's no consequence that can keep me sober. Nothing, you know? You can't, I mean, like, I don't want to go to jail, you know? But, like, jail is not enough to keep me sober. It's like the threat of jail is not going to be enough. And that was the really terrifying thing that I realized about myself, you know, later on. And So I got out of there, and I tried to drink moderately, and which is a great experiment, and I think that everyone, you know, if you haven't tried it, you should. But it didn't really work for me because, like, my idea of drinking moderately was just that I'm gonna black out a couple times a week instead of every night of the week, right? So just black out on the weekends and then go to school. And I had all these rules for myself, you know, about how I was gonna avoid trouble and still drink. And it was just, you know, and this is the thing is that I erased those lines one by one. You know, I remember the first time where someone was like, "Do you wanna like before class when someone was like, "Do you wanna drink?" And I was like, you know what? Drinking before class isn't that bad. I just won't drink after class when I have to go see my family, you know? So I, like, started drinking before class. And then they were like, you know, on my lunch break, they were like, "Do you want to drink?" And I was like, "Sure." Right? Like, why not? And then I was like, as long as I don't drink after class, I'll be fine, you know? And then someone offered me a drink after school. And I was like, "Sure," you know? And within 2 weeks, I was drinking the exact same way that I'd been drinking before I left, you know? And within maybe a month and a half, I was acting the same way that I'd acted before I left, you know. The cops were getting called to my house. My mom would lock herself in her room with my little sister and cry herself to sleep every night. They would never, I mean, my mom didn't leave her purse in the same, in an unlocked room nearby me, ever, you know. And she, I started getting those looks again from my family of just, like, total despair and, like, fear and anger and worry. And I would get those looks every day, you know, before I left, when I was getting home, and really, like, but, you know, and I started feeling that feeling in my gut again of, you know, like, that I, like, these people just don't get it. They really just don't understand, you know. If they would just leave me alone and let me drink, I would be okay. And I was told that if I kept drinking, and if I kept getting in trouble, I was going to go to another long-term institution, you know, which clearly wasn't a joke, right, because I'd just gotten out of a 15-month manual labor camp, and so I knew that that was what was going to happen if I kept drinking, you know. And so really the question is, for if you're thinking about, like, you know, am I an alcoholic or not, it's like, why would you drink, right? Why would you drink if you know that once you start drinking, you can't stop, and you know that once you, like, get into that situation, you're going to get sent away? Why would you ever drink? Why would you ever pick up the first drink? And I couldn't answer that question. I couldn't tell you why I did it, you know. I mean, I knew that alcohol gave me relief. I knew that in that moment that I really just wanted that relief more than I wanted anything in the world, but I can't tell you why I'm unable to think of the consequences and make a decision based on those, you know, because if I could, I would not be in Madison, Virginia on a Sunday night. I guarantee you that. I just wouldn't drink, you know, and if I could, I wouldn't need AA, honestly, but, you know, I'd hit that point where once I started drinking, there was just no telling what was going to happen. You know, I drank anyways, but I had no idea where I was going to wind up. Might be miles away from where I started. I usually was with a group of people I didn't know. And, you know, so I knew that about myself. Like, once I start drinking, I can't stop. But I started to get that second part of the first step, you know, that once I stop drinking, there's just no telling when I'm going to pick up my next drink, you know. And for me, you know, that's the nature of my alcoholism, you know, is that once I start, there's no telling what's going to happen, and whenever I stop, there's no consequence that can keep me sober, you know, and that I will always drink again, always, without fail, and I'm just incapable of living in a way that makes not picking up a drink possible, you know. I act like a jerk all the time when I'm sober, and some of the worst things I've ever done in my entire life was when I was stone cold sober, and how do you explain that, you know? And so, you know, what wound up happening is I woke up at 1 o'clock in the morning. Well, I mean, what wound up happening actually is that, and I normally don't tell this part because it's kind of embarrassing, but I was walking around by myself outside and talking to myself pretty much, because I didn't believe in God, you know, but I would talk to myself out loud to clear my thoughts, and I just spoke, like, kind of ambiguously, and I was like, you know, if there's something out there, you know, if I'm, because I really, like, felt like, I knew that what I was doing was wrong, but at the same time, I felt like people just wouldn't leave me alone, you know? And so I was like, you know, if I'm doing something wrong, let me know. Give me a sign, you know? And nothing happened. You know, burning bush. Doves didn't appear and, like, flap away. It was just, and so I was like, all right, got my answer, you know? And I went home and I went to sleep. And a couple hours later, I woke up to these two, like, huge guys in my room. And they were escorts, and not like the fun kind of escorts, the scary kind of escorts, you know, who take you places you don't want to go, although other escorts might do that sometimes, but these were not like the fun kind, and they drove me to upstate New York 4 days before Christmas, which like lets you know that you're being a real winner at home, you know, when you get sent away 4 days before Christmas. And I signed into this institution. It was an 18-month program. And I remember lying down in that bed and thinking to myself, that was when I felt hopeless and desperate, you know, because I couldn't, I had no answer for why I'd wound up in this situation, you know, none. Like, I couldn't honestly tell you why I was in another long-term institution. And really, because I don't want, I mean, you know, I might not care about my family, I might not care about school, I might not care about a job, I might not care about money, but I really do care about my freedom, you know? Like, I don't like people telling me when to pee, when to eat, who I can call, what to do. I really, really hate that at the bottom of my soul. And yet, I was in another institution where that was going to be my life for 18 months, you know? And so I felt like, for the first time, you know, that I really felt hopeless because I can't drink, you know, I can't not drink, and, you know, whenever I'm sober, I feel unbearable, and whenever I drink, I wind up in institutions, and I can't seem to live in a way that keeps me out of trouble, you know, and I did not have a way of life that could help me stay sober and feel comfortable in my own skin, and the bottom line was that I for the first time, really kind of got that, you know, and I remember waking up in that bed, like, and I was about a foot away from, like, a light like this, you know, one of these fluorescent lights, and just shaking my head and just being like, how did this happen, you know? And I feel like most alcoholics, you know, pretty much everyone that I've ever talked to has had a moment like that, you know? And it might not be in an institution, but where you just are like, how did this happen, you know? And just really not having an answer for yourself. And that is a really desperate feeling, you know? So I tried to kind of do the same thing I'd always done and, like, play the game, like the rehab game, and it just wasn't really, my heart wasn't in it anymore, to be honest with you. I just had kind of, on some level, I'd given up, you know, and I did have one, like, final acting out, which was the most, really, just like I wish it was a Blaze of Glory story, you know, where I, like, was throwing chairs at staff and saying, like, you'll never get me, but I really was just acting like a baby, and so they sent me to isolation and made me sit by myself. And I went on hunger strike. This was at breakfast time, and I made it till lunch, I think, if that. And Steve was watching me while I was in there, and I think, at least for a little while, or he stopped by. But it was not like a flattering way to go out, you know. It was not a flattering end to like last stand. But I can honestly say that I gave up then. I really did, you know. I hit my knees and I said, I don't know what's wrong with me, but I don't want to feel this way anymore, and I'm willing to do whatever I have to do to not feel this way. And you know, this was after everyone had left, you know, there's no one paying attention to me anymore. They just had given me like a sheet, you know, and I was in this little 5x5 box, you know. And I just realized that, like, for the rest of my life, like, that was as good as it was going to get for me, really. It was, like, them people putting me in boxes. And I really gave up, you know. And what happened after that was that people brought meetings of AA into this institution from D.C. They drove from D.C. to Hancock, New York, and brought meetings in. Which is, you know, I got back from doing that this weekend. And if those people hadn't come, I don't know if I would have gotten sober, you know, because I knew that I was hopeless, but I still didn't have an answer. And the only messages I got from these people, really, I didn't really hear their stories very well, but I just heard that they were sober and they were comfortable in their own skin. And those are two things that I was just incapable of doing on my own, you know. I kind of made up my mind that, I mean, I moved to D.C. after I left there because I felt like that was the only place I could stay sober, you know. Whereas, and I know that's not true today, but it was these people had made it very clear to me that they were living a way of life, that they were sober and comfortable in their own skin. And I really did, like, want that more than anything that I could think of, you know. And I thought that I was never going to have fun again for the rest of my life once I got sober. But honestly, at that point, I was kind of okay with that. You know, I was okay with being boring for the rest of my life as long as I didn't keep getting put in these institutions. And so I really did the best I could while I was in that rehab to start living by principle. And I just was, like, really misguided and didn't know what I was doing. But I tried. I really did try. And I got a sponsor that was in D.C. And when I left, I moved down there, and I started working the steps, you know. He had me read the doctor's opinion, and we talked about it, and that was where I kind of started getting an idea that I, not just the idea that I'm lonely, not just the idea that I feel bad, not just the idea that these people are happy and I'm not happy, but the idea that, like, I'm an alcoholic, and that Alcoholics Anonymous is my answer, you know? And I, you know, found out that I have a fatal disease, you know? There's no way out for someone like me, and the best I really can hope for is being institutionalized for the rest of my life. And that once I start drinking, I can't stop. And once I stop drinking, I have no idea when I'm going to start again. And that I'm incapable of living in a way that makes me comfortable in my own skin. And that's what makes me a hopeless alcoholic. And that AA, like, you know, this deal is for people who are in that situation, you know. And I thought that I was too young. I thought that I did drugs too much. I thought that, you know, I had all these things that I thought. But really, if that's your relationship with alcohol, then this will work for you. And that's the bottom line. And I kind of got my first and second step that way, you know, like that, you know, I'm an alcoholic and this can work for me. And that was about as complicated as it needed to be for me at that time. And then, you know, the third step I read through and I looked back on my experience and really, you know, that was kind of a game changer for me because I was told that that the drinking wasn't my problem, that selfishness was my problem, which is a really kind of disappointing thing to hear, you know, because that means that I have to like do stuff differently than I've been doing stuff and that I have to change the way that I live if I want to stay sober. And you know, so my sponsor kind of hammered that point home to me, you know, that the insanity of the first drink will come back if you don't live in a way that's different than the way you were living before, you know. And the best decision that I could make, you know, when I really like made that third step decision was when I started putting pen to paper on the fourth step, you know. And the third step definitely means more to me now than it did then. But that was the absolute best thing that I could have done at that time, was start writing my fourth step, you know. Because if I want to start moving forward, I have to know who and what I am. Like, what are we working with here? And that's what I got on my fourth step, you know. I found out that I was petty. I found out that I was a baby. I found out that, you know, when I walk into a room, I size everybody up. And if you're higher than me on the totem pole, then I kind of like want to be your friend and want you, you know, desperately vie for your approval, and if I think you're lower than me on the totem pole, then I treat you like crap in front of the people that are higher up so that they'll like me, you know? And I'm not a good guy, really. You know, I don't care about people. You know, I care about me. And I kind of found out the selfishness was my problem, and I found out exactly what that looks like, to have selfishness be your problem, you know, to treat people like things, and to just, really just to use people to get what I want. And that was kind of what I got out of my fourth step, you know, it was a real, real upper. And afterwards, you know, and when I did my fifth step, and I shared that with my sponsor, you know, really that was the first time in my life that I really felt, like it's talked about in the book, conceding to your innermost self, you're alcoholic. And when I did my fifth step was when I really conceded to my innermost self that I was alcoholic, you know. I really could see what it was that I did, you know, what kind of person I am, you know. And the way that I live, the best way that I can ever live, you know, which is on that fourth step. Because I tried to do better. I wasn't trying to be a jerk all the time, you know. I really wanted to be, like, a good guy. Like, if I could have picked, you know, I would have been, but I'm just, like, not capable of doing that. And that's who and what I really am. And I also, you know, for the first time in my life, someone knew everything about me, you know. And before that point, people knew bits and pieces, and they knew exactly as much as I would let them get away with, you know, and exactly as much as I needed to manipulate them. And for the first time in my life, someone knew the whole thing, you know, and they knew my secrets, the things I was going to take to my grave with me, you know, the things that would keep me up at night. And I'd never had that experience before, you know, and I remember sitting for my hour after I'd done my fifth step and really for the first time feeling like a little bit of peace, you know, and a little bit of peace, not a lot of peace, a little bit of peace. And then, you know, I got to 6 and 7 and I was like, yeah, I know. And I didn't really pay any attention to what that meant, what the 6 and 7 step meant. I didn't have a clue, but the most I did for 6 and 7 at that time was that my sponsor told me I can't make amends until I start acting better. And if I don't make my amends, I'll drink again. And so I was like, all right, well, I'm going to start acting better, you know? And I tried to start acting better, and I didn't do a very good job, you know, up until when I was 8 months sober, my mom had to stop the car and walk away because she was crying so hard, you know. And that was stone cold sober in AA, you know. I treated people like that still. And I didn't have the slightest idea how to act by principle. But I really did try, and I started looking around and seeing examples in Alcoholics Anonymous of people who were living this thing, you know. And a couple of guys that come up here pretty regularly, James and Travis, like those are the guys who are picking me up and taking me to meetings and explaining this thing to me, you know. And if they hadn't taken the time to do that, like if they hadn't been examples of AA, like I don't know what I would have done. And I would go up to D.C. on the weekends and hang out with those guys, and I saw a lot of people acting by principle there. And I started learning what it meant to be a son and to be a brother and to be a friend and to be a student and to, like, show up in all these areas, you know. And I, you know, did my eighth step, which was pretty easy because it was just the fourth column of my fourth step. And then I started making amends. And I went down to Charlottesville and I didn't have a car, so I just rode the bus around Charlottesville and started paying back all these people and making amends, and that was terrifying. I mean, that's terrifying. For someone like me, it is my worst nightmare to admit that I'm wrong, you know? And not only that, but, like, to admit that I'm wrong in a very formal setting is awful, awful, you know? And I really did not want to do that, but I also really didn't want to drink again. You know, my life had gotten better enough by this point that I really wanted to have what other people had. You know, I wanted to feel comfortable in my own skin, and so I started making my amends, and I'll start off, you know, I went to Monticello High School, and I'd stolen all of their speakers out of their auditorium, like taking the fronts off, taking the speakers out, and then put the covers back on. So it took them like a week to figure out that there's no sound, but I was long gone. So I had to go back and pay them back for that. And you know, you hear these amends stories about people going back and, like, paying things off and having that person say, like, thank you so much for being a better person, you know, or whatever. Or, like, and when you ask, like, what can I do? They're like, nothing. Just keep doing what you're doing, you know? And this guy was like, get out of here. He's like, yeah, pay and then leave, and you're not allowed back here ever, you know? And that was like my very first one. And I called my sponsor. I was like, I don't know, man. Like, I don't really know if I could do this. And pretty much almost all my amends went like that. You know, people really told me how they felt. I didn't have any warm and fuzzy moments. I made amends to my stepsisters, one of whom I used to drink with all the time, so I figured she would be cool, right? And the other one, we never really talked, so I figured no problem. And the one who I drank with all the time told me, she's like, I can't, she's like, we were afraid whenever you were home. You know, we had no idea what you were going to do. And once you started drinking, we just didn't know what was going to happen. And it was terrifying living in the same house as you. Which is not a flattering thing to hear, you know? And then I made amends to my sister, and she said she was scared all the time, you know? Because of the way that I wanted to live. And you know, like, really, like, from each of these kind of, like, you know, what I got out of doing my nine-step amends was I got a little bit of truth about myself that I couldn't get from the fourth step, that I couldn't get from just writing my eight-step list, that I couldn't get from just hearing people talk. Like, I really felt to the depth, to my core, like, what kind of a person I was, you know? And for me, the ninth step, you know, was not... Making my amends was the beginning of something I got to do for the rest of my life. You know, making my amends did not end this... put all this madness behind me, you know? Making my amends is kind of just like a landmark, you know, that you just kind of keep moving past. It's like, oh, all right, on forward, you know, because making those relationships right was not solved by just saying I was wrong. You know, making those relationships right has a lot more to do with what am I going to do after I am done talking, you know. And that's really what the other thing that I got from my family was like, okay, cool, like, see where it goes from here, you know, because I'd said I'm sorry 1,000 times, you know. And I'd said, what can I do to make it better 1,000 times? What they wanted to see was me acting differently, you know. Being a member of AA didn't mean anything to them. You know, they were optimistic, but it wasn't enough. And I made amends with my mom, and she said, and my mom is, you know, like this tall and like the nicest person in the world, right? And she said, you know, it's okay. It was in the past. And you know, we've moved forward from there. But I don't want to minimize it because you were an asshole. And I was like, you know? And she was like, I'm your mom, so I always want to see the good in you. But there's a really long time where I couldn't see any good in you. And honestly, like, that's like, that really is like the truth about the kind of person I am, you know, is that like any outside observer looking at the way that I live, like, there was not any indication that I gave a shit about anything but myself. And the reason it looked that way is because I didn't, you know, I really didn't. what I cared about was how can I get mine, you know? And if you were in my way, you just need to get out of my way, and I'll do whatever I have to, you know, to get to, like, get what I want. And so I, you know, and pretty much, you know, my amends, like, went along that track. You know, I flew to England and made amends to my dad, and he has had, you know, his own experience with AA and was not really having the amends conversation. So I had to kind of do it in a tricky way and say, like, you know, talk about how, you know, I'd been a bad son and I wanted to move forward, you know, and like I said, like, he really wasn't having it. He doesn't think I'm alcoholic, which is fine for him not to think that, you know. He didn't want AA to be a burden for me, you know. And really, I told him that, A, you know, this is not a burden for me, you know, like living the way that I was living before and being the kind of son I was to you was a burden, you know, because I would call this guy up, just call him up out of the blue and scream horrible things at him and tell him I hated him, you know, and that he wasn't my father. And I wish that I could say that things are really, have gotten better between us. You know, I've gone over there twice to see him. We talk somewhat regularly, but I haven't done that great of a job on following up on that amends, you know. And I really, really do regret that, because I went over there this past summer and I really did not spend as much time with him as I should have, you know. And I just still have so much resentment there, you know. And with pretty much everyone else that I made amends to, making my amends was the final nail in the coffin on those resentments, you know. But with my dad, it's like still something that I have a hard time with, you know. And what I've learned, if anything, is just that the only way that I can move forward is by acting differently, you know, and that I can't expect that relationship to get any better until I start acting better towards him, you know. If I don't call him regularly, if I'm not making that effort, things are going to stay exactly where they are, you know. And so that's one thing that, you know, that's probably the thing I regret the most since I've been sober, has been, like, that I didn't make more of an effort with him. And obviously, like, you know, but I talked to my sponsor about that stuff, and I talked about what ways I can move forward, you know, and so that was, you know, my amends were really the point at which, you know, it says in the book right after that that, you know, our real job now is to be of maximum service to God and to the people about us, you know, to place ourselves in a position to be of maximum service. And I really feel like that's kind of the theme of 10, 11, and 12 for me, is about putting myself in a position where I can really be helpful, you know. And that's something that's, like, become more and more important to me, I feel like, in the last year than it ever was before, you know, about thinking about how can I be in a position where I'm really able to be helpful, you know. And for me, because for me, that entails a lot more than just, like, talking to people about AA, right, or trying to help the new guy in the room. Like, putting yourself in a position to be helpful requires, you know, regularly taking inventory. It requires regularly going over inventory with my sponsor, you know. It requires, you know, looking at what defects of character are popping up on my inventory. It requires a genuine desire to grow, you know, and to kind of, like, to put the things in my inventory aside, to be willing to let go of the character defects, even if they're not making me uncomfortable, you know, so that I can be more helpful. And that was something that I, you know, and that's, like, kind of was where I started getting 6 and 7, like, well after I was supposed to be a 6 and 7, you know. Like, I started getting that, like, when I started regularly doing a 10th step. Because I started seeing there's stuff that I do regularly, right, that is not okay and that does not make people feel comfortable around me. And I'm a very sarcastic, kind of snappy person, which I it's hard to imagine, but it's true. And I always have a quick response, you know, or I usually have a quick response. And I'm just like, I don't know, I'm just all about cutting people down, really. And I get a certain sense of pleasure out of, you know, snapping at people and making them feel like they're a couple notches below me, you know. And that's just the honest truth. Like, I still get a little bit of pleasure in my gut out of that. But I get a lot more, I get an entirely different kind of feeling from building someone up, you know. And I guess, like, why I've started trying to do a regular inventory and go over it with my sponsor and do my 11th step and pray in the morning and pray at night and try and help people has been because it makes me not want to live that way, you know. I didn't stop gossiping or stop trying to gossip because gossiping made me feel bad. Like, I've stopped trying to gossip because how can a new guy feel comfortable reading his 5th step to someone who hears talking about people behind their back all the time, you know. I didn't stop trying to lash out and be angry at people because I felt bad about that necessarily. Like, I stopped lashing out because, you know, when you're hanging out with new people all the time, like, you feel bad when you're a bad example, you know? And so that's why it's, you know, trying to place myself in a position to be helpful has really been the theme of, of what do I do once I've completed my amends, you know, because I want people to feel comfortable around me, and I want to people to feel comfortable telling me what I'm doing something wrong, and I want them to feel comfortable asking me for help, you know, and I can't be that person unless I'm regularly trying to grow, and that's just the bottom line, you know. And, you know, my 12-step experience really has been that, you know, I absolutely have had a spiritual experience that talks about the steps, you know. Like, I view the world differently now than I did when I was drinking. There's just no question about that, you know. I'm not perfect. Like, I mess up all the time. And I really, you know, especially if you start regularly doing inventory, like, you'll figure that out pretty quick. Like, I'm not, like, I might not be much better of a guy, you know, but I definitely am different and see the world differently now than I did then, you know. Like, I definitely wake up more days than I used to and think about what can I give instead of what can I get, you know. I have much more frequently now try and, like, do things for other people, you know, and think about, like, what can I do so that there's nothing between me and the people around me. And that is not the attitude that I used to have, clearly, right? And I'll tell you, I feel like just the best example for that of me is seeing people who, seeing people, like, get good things when it has nothing to do with me and genuinely feeling happy for them, you know? You know, and that's happened with the guys that I sponsor, when amazing things happen in their life and it has nothing to do with me. You know, when I saw this guy who was bouncing in and out for years, you know, and in my first couple months he was in and out and in and out and in and out, and seeing him pick up a one-year chip, you know, and these moments where I truly, truly feel like I couldn't be happier for these people, you know. And that, like, to me is, like, really the essence of a spiritual experience because, you know, I was just incapable of feeling anything for anyone, you know. And today, like, I have these brief moments where I genuinely do give a shit. You know, I genuinely do. And that hasn't happened because of anything that I did, you know. Like, that's happened as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous and really genuinely trying to do this thing, you know, and being willing to grow. I guess the bottom line is, like, am I willing to grow, you know. And I'll tell you, if you're new or if you're not new and you feel, like, if you feel terrible, I understand, you know. I found that that the bottom line is I have to have a sponsor who I talk to every day. I have to have friends who I talk to about my inventory regularly and who hold me accountable. And I have to be actively helping new people, you know, because the only reason I'm sober is because someone took the time to explain Alcoholics Anonymous to me, you know, because they went out of their way to make me feel comfortable, to, like, save me a seat and, like, remember my name. Like, those things were a huge deal to me when I was first getting sober, you know. And if I'm not regularly doing those things, then I have no gratitude for what I got, you know. And I have a really, really amazing life, like, a lot of really cool stuff, you know. But I wouldn't have any of this if people hadn't done that for me. You know, there's just no question about that. So I am about out of time, and I'm really grateful, you know, to be able to have, like, an opportunity to come down here and see so many of the people who have really, you know, really, like, helped change my life. And I don't know. I think that's all I got, but thank you.